back to Memory Static, everybody. It's your once every once in a while host, Eric Dumig, hosting the show today because you guessed it. It is Bailey's birthday once again. And so we're going to have Bailey pick the movie. Hello, Bailey. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Eric. I'm glad to be here.
Wonderful. Can you tell us what movie we're going to watch today?
We're going to be watching an animated movie from the 70s called The Mouse and His Child.
The Mouse and His Child from the 1970s. Awesome. To get us rolling on this, why did you pick this movie and what did it mean to you when you were, you know, when you saw it when you were growing up? And have you seen it recently?
Well, I have seen it recently. But first time I watched it, I was 3 or 4 years old, because we were living with my grandmother at the time, and that's how I know the age, because we moved out of that house when I was right before I turned 5. We watched it a few times. We had it on VHS, and at a certain point in time, my sister, who loved playing with the VCR, ended up hitting the record button and recorded over the movie, and I never saw it again until I was, I don't know, it was just a couple years ago, and I found it on YouTube.
Wow. So you had it on VHS? You had like purchased it on VHS, or you saw it on TV and recorded it initially?
I think my mom recorded it off the TV. I have no idea what channel it was on, and I didn't remember much about the movie, except for the fact that there were two mice that were a toy, and they were connected, and that there was a part where they were underwater and stuck in the mud, and there was this, you know, one of those infinity images, mm-hmm. where an image goes inside an image, goes inside an image, goes inside an image forever. And that idea really disturbed me when I was a kid, and it stuck with me. Like I never completely dropped that from my brain, which is why I sought the movie out years later.
Oh my gosh. Well, this actually segues perfectly into one of my questions, because I similarly thought that moment, the like mise en abyme moment, I think that's what it's called, where like a picture goes into like an infinite tunnel of the same image.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask you if you had any moments like this as a child where like your mind was like conceptually blown, you know, like mm-hmm. where an image either really stuck with you and like what kind of effect that had on you, or some kind of concept that's like kind of bigger than your mind can really process as a child and what that was like.
Well, I would say the first time that something like that occurred to me, and this is going to be a little dark, but when I was about 3 years old, I was asking my parents about dinosaurs, and my mom told me that they were extinct. And when I asked what that was, they said, well, that just means that they're gone. They all died and they're never coming back. And I was able to relate the plight of the dinosaurs to my own existence, and I understood death. And it was not something that I was really prepared for as a three-year-old to really comprehend. And so for a really long time, I was crying myself to sleep every night, thinking about my family dying, or, you know, me dying and not recognizing them in the hereafter.
Hmm.
So that, I think that's probably the first big concept that was more than I could really take in. But, you know, I think as adults, we still struggle with that one.
Yeah, no kidding. I want to follow up on that. You said you kind of started to grasp this concept of death as a kid, and I'm interested in like what that looked like. Was that going hand in hand with a concept of an afterlife, or like what did you think happened, and has that changed at all as an adult in a big way?
Well, so this is also very strange. I don't know why this is what my idea of heaven would be like, but I thought that when you died, you went to heaven, but heaven was not really tangible in any way. It didn't really resemble the world that we live in. And you were kind of this essence of yourself. And as that essence, we were unrecognizable to each other from any past experience. And actually, like, you would shrug off those memories because they didn't matter so much anymore. And that was the thing that really, really upset me, that these people that I could love that wouldn't recognize me after I died, and I wouldn't recognize them.
Wow, what a neat concept. If I can remember, I think I had similar thoughts about if one of the concepts that goes along with heaven is that you get to see your relatives who have also passed, would they be the age that they were when they passed, or would they be a different age or something like that? I feel like I remember thinking some of those thoughts as like a young child, but then also some of what you were talking about, like being completely unrecognizable, kind of the way that characters can kind of play themselves out in dreams, like where they might look like someone else, but you recognize them as a specific person because of the like emotional affect or like the spirit quality of them. And sometimes you just don't recognize people in dreams at all, even though like they might look just like someone you see all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Well, that's really neat. It's really interesting that you picked a movie that you saw for the first time when you were like three, because I think about that time period and it's like we barely even have memories that we can actually hold from that time period. You know, if we do have any, they're typically very vague or really affected by emotion or something. So I guess that would be another question I have for you, or like, can you tell me about the images that come up when you think about your earliest memories?
Okay, so I was pretty self-aware at 3 years old. I feel like memories before that are a little bit more amorphous. We moved from New Orleans when I was about 1.5.
That's where you were born, is New Orleans?
Yes. Yes, I was born in New Orleans. And we moved from there to Houston when I was about 1.5 to live with my grandmother. And I don't really remember much about that, but I do have this memory that I've gone back to occasionally throughout my life, where I see a young woman with a broom sweeping the sidewalk. And I know from conversations with my mother that that was this girl, Amy, that lived close by and would sometimes babysit me.
Huh. Whoa.
Yeah.
And you just saw her sweeping the sidewalk? She lived in your neighborhood and you would just see her doing this as like a chore?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I have no idea what the context of this memory is. It's just an image.
Huh. That's so interesting. Wow. Yeah, I think about a similar situation for myself, and I remember even as like a 4 or 5 year old having like a pre-memory of like a tunnel with like Christmas lights in it, moving through it very quickly with colored lights around. And my parents told me that this is the most likely thing that this could have been would have been a ride at like a Six Flags in, I want to say, one of the Carolinas or something. Like, I think we took a trip down there with my older brother and my older sister when I was like 2.
Whoa.
But I don't remember it, but I have video of one of the things that we did there was we made like a music video that we have on VHS. That was one of those things at like theme parks where you could go in front of a green screen and like make a music video. They would play the music and you just like dance and like pretend to play the instruments. I think my dad was playing the drums and Crow and I are just like jumping around because we were doing this to the classic 90s jam Jump by Chris Cross. And they told me that this happened at the Six Flags. So they're like, okay, yeah, that's probably what that tunnel dream is.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I still remember some dreams that I had way back when. I feel like now it's harder to remember my dreams than it was when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I would hold those dreams in my head for a really long time, for years and years and years. But now, like, I can't remember them once I wake up in the morning.
Right. Yeah. I have to, like, write them down if I want to remember them, or, like, really capture them and sit with them for, like, a good minute without doing anything that might let that dissolve, like checking my phone or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I have one other question for you before we step into the time machine. One of the other cool concepts I noticed in this movie is this idea of self-winding, right? Like these two main characters, the mouse and his child, they're a wind-up toy and they can't move themselves without being wound. This becomes such a poignant image, like they consistently need the help of just anyone who's around. They're like completely helpless without someone who has the ability to do so winding them up. But there's this strong desire that they have to be self-winding toys. And so I wanted to ask you about some memories of some of your first self-winding moments, something that maybe, you know, used to require a lot of help from somebody, whether your parents or like your surrounding environment, and then where you were able to really do it by yourself?
The first thing that comes to mind, and I think this is probably a lot of the first self-winding moments that people will have, being able to tie your shoes.
Sure.
Or like dressing yourself. And like, those are the basic things I think we learn how to do, or to read a book by yourself.
Oh, yeah, reading.
But I guess like the first thing that I can think of, that something big that I did on my own, it was completely of my own, what's the word? My self-instigated thing. When I was in first grade, I decided that I wanted to organize an art contest. And I talked to my teacher about it. And, you know, I think she just thought it was really cute. And so she encouraged me. And we got the other classroom, the adjoining classroom, because the school that I grew up in didn't have full walls. So, like, some of the classrooms were divided by false walls that were usually chalkboards and stuff. Mm-hmm. So the other classroom that was on the other side of those chalkboards also participated in my art contest. And I didn't know what the term biased meant, but I understood it as a concept. And so I knew that people could call me out for picking favorites if it was just me. So I also elected to have an assistant that would help me judge.
Oh, wow.
And then I made a bunch of prizes for places 1st through 10th.
Oh, wow. How many participants were there?
I'm guessing there was probably 15 to 20 children in each classroom.
And two classes.
Two classes, yeah.
Oh, wow. Everyone participated.
Everyone participated.
Okay, great.
Everyone made something that they put into the art contest, and they could do whatever they wanted. And the picture that me and Ashley chose was this one by a kid named Derek, and we were not friends, so no one could claim that I was picking a favorite, but I chose him as first prize because he drew this rooster with a thought bubble or a speech bubble, and it said something funny that made me laugh. And so they got first place because it was funny to me.
Awesome. Oh, man, that's so cool. I love that. Oh, I love that you had to get an assistant too, because you knew people would like call you out for playing favorites if you did. That's so funny.
Yeah, it's funny how like, you know, as a kid, you can grasp certain things without having the vocabulary.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm interested, like, how did that whole setup work? Like, did you just go to your teachers and be like, I want to do this? And then how did that all come together?
You know, I can't really say for sure. I don't really remember. Uh-huh. I just know I had an idea and then it happened magically. There were probably, the adults were probably helping facilitate all of it. Because otherwise, like, how could a first grade child really put on an art show?
Right.
Like, I didn't staple the stuff to the walls, you know?
Right.
Someone else
right.
did.
Yeah.
But, you know, those things seem to happen by magic when you're a kid. Like holiday parties.
Uh-huh.
You have no idea as a child how much time and effort and energy goes into putting together something like that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I remember at my school where I went to kindergarten through second grade, we had like several really cool events that would happen throughout the year. And one of them was called International Night. And it would be a thing where, you know, after school, like around five or six, maybe seven, like as it's getting dark, students would come back to the school and they will set up several classrooms in the school to be themed by certain countries. And there would be like some kind of activity or performance in each of those rooms. Mm-hmm. It must have taken a bunch of coordination to get that pulled off. But it just seemed like, you know, I left school when it looked normal. And then 2 hours later, it's just like there, you know, and the whole school is transformed into this like miracle party, you know.
I know.
Well, that brings us to the point where I think it's about time to step into the time machine. But I have a question for you. I mean, obviously, it's 2020 and we're doing this over Zoom because we can't be in the same room as each other because of the pandemic. So how does this work? Have you done any augmentations to the time machine to get this to work?
Yes, actually. I just tried it out for the first time for the last episode, and there was a couple hiccups. Colin didn't have a very good time in the time machine, but I think I have figured it out. So you notice the door behind me, right? You see the time machine?
I do.
Okay. Now look behind you. You might see another door.
What? How is this happening?
I have tweaked the time machine to, like, not just be able to travel through time, but to also be in two spaces at the same time, sort of. So the door, I'll go through my door here, you go through your door there, and we'll both end up in the same time machine.
Unbelievable. I think Google should give us, like, grant money. We're solving the quantum problem here. Like, we're really getting out ahead on the technological sphere. Like, they should give us, like a MacArthur grant or something.
And I'm doing it all intuitively. I don't have any training in engineering or science.
We're just trying our best, you know, out here, just putting machines together, making it happen.
Yeah, so once you go through, there will be, like, some special plexiglass that separates the time machine, and so there will be no shared air. And
I see. Wonderful. Two separate HVAC systems.
Exactly.
We really thought this out, y'all. Just making sure everybody knows.
We're being safe.
This time machine experience is going to be properly physically distanced and pandemic safe. Awesome. Let's step in.
All right, let's go.
All time machine systems online. Systems go.
Oh, wow. I like the new decorations, too. It's nice and, like, well-lit in here. The lighting changes are very good. I like some of the new beep boop machines. You know, very good.
Yeah, I always take the opportunity to enhance the aesthetics in the time machine whenever I can.
It's a really important part of time travel is making sure you're comfortable. It can be sometimes an uncomfortable experience traveling through time, even traveling through time at a slow pace, you know?
Yeah.
But speaking of movies, we're going to talk about a really fun one today. I've done some digging and found a bunch of neat connections with regard to this movie, The Mouse and His Child. So right out the gate, this is a movie that came out, I want to say, in 1977 in the United States. It was an American movie, but made to be released in both the United States and Japan, and was distributed in Japan through Sanrio, which is the company that made Hello Kitty. So I think not the first time we've done a Sanrio movie, although I don't know if that episode ever came out.
That's right.
We did a secret episode that never actually came out about a movie called Unico and the Island of Magic, which was also a Sanrio distributed film.
That's right.
Very, very cool that we're doing another Japanese-American collaboration movie. For fans of the show, you'll recognize that this came up in our Little Nemo Adventures in Slumberland episode with Katie Green. That movie was also an American-Japanese co-production, though this one was pretty much entirely made in the United States, but was meant to be distributed both in the States and in Japan.
That's so fascinating.
The people who produced it is a production company called Murakami Wolf Swenson, which I believe now is just referred to as Fred Wolf Films.
Oh, it still exists.
It seems like they might still exist. The original company went defunct in 1999, but then kind of reemerged in 2013.
Whoa.
As Fred Wolf Films.
Interesting.
But originally, it was Murakami Wolf Swenson or Murakami Wolf Films. Murakami, I believe, is an American, a Japanese-American, and his partner, Wolf. And these folks, they are actually pretty famous for some other really cool animated projects that you might have heard of. One of them is the studio-produced movie The Point, a feature film from the 1970s using...
Harry Nilsson's music, you know.
That's
and I,
right.
I want to cover The Point at some point because I know someone the soundtrack is very significant to.
Yeah, same. If my homies Emily Price or Kanan Davis are listening to this episode, thanks for showing me The Point, y'all. That was a crazy movie.
I still haven't seen it, so
it's wild.
I've heard the music though. I've heard all the music.
Mm-hmm. Murakami Wolf also produced Puff the Magic Dragon.
That's right.
And was the animation house behind the 1980s and 90s Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles animated show.
Wow.
Which was an adaptation from a comic book at the time. They didn't invent the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, but they did produce the animated series in the 1980s and 1990s.
I grew up with that show. I was all about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and the Ghostbusters, and I loved both of those animated shows. And, you know, the first five episodes of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is actually really, really great. Once it gets past those first five, it starts to get a little rougher, but...
Mm-hmm. I haven't gone back and seen it in a little while, but thinking about it now, I actually see some kind of, like, animation analogs between the rat guy from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and...
Splinter.
Splinter, Master Splinter, and the rat in this movie. They have a kind of similar look to them.
That is a really good point. I had not noticed that. I think the animation in this movie is really cool.
It's quite good. Yeah, it's quite good. You know, I'm always stoked to see American animation that's not Disney, and then not Don Bluth, right?
Right.
Who is pretty much like most of the American animation that people of your and my age would have seen.
Right. And not Ralph Bakshi, because that's the other one
that... Yeah. And then, of course, there's like all the Hanna-Barbera and like, you know, the TV animators. But yeah, definitely. These guys also did the reboot of The New Adventures of Speed Racer in America as
okay.
well. Okay. Which was fun. Beyond that, let's see. Some other stuff that I found out about this movie is that it was released on VHS in 1985 and then re-released in 1991, but never had a DVD release in the United States, though it did in Japan.
Oh.
I watched this movie on YouTube, which is where you told me to watch it, and it is available for those looking to watch the film. It isn't available in full on YouTube, but apparently still to date does not have a DVD release. So if one of y'all out there has one of those original VHSs, you got a gem on your hands.
What I remember was that it has been out of distribution since it was released on VHS,
mm-hmm.
and that no one has any interest in getting it out there, which I think is such a shame. I know it's not paced in a modern way. It's kind of slow, but I still think that it's a movie worth watching, and it's got some really interesting themes for a children's movie.
Most definitely. Like, I felt a lot while watching this movie that there's definitely some amount of vibe that comes off of it that feels very much like it came out of some of the kind of psychedelic experience in that time period. And there's a lot of like funny wordplay, like with some of the stuff that the muskrat says, where he's doing these like funny math problems, you know, this times this equals this, and just kind of using words as math in a really interesting way that really reminded me a little bit of some of the stuff from Phantom Tollbooth, where they're like, they got the math and the word people. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this movie was, when it came out, it didn't receive much good critical acclaim. In fact, Leonard Maltin gave it the rating bomb, which is his lowest rating out of 4 stars, saying, boring animated film, talk, 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 and no action. And in addition to that, Janet Maslin of the New York Times praised the direction, the writing, and the music score, but criticized the darker elements and stated that, quote, 83 minutes is a long time for an adult to think about mice, which I find to be a very, very interesting review, considering in the next decade, Don Bluth released not one, but two
mice movies,
feature animated films about mice.
And
that
they're dark.
Good and beloved.
Yes.
Yeah, they are dark. Very dark. Both The Secret of Nim and An American Tale are quite dark movies with intense themes that are all about mice.
I think it's interesting the way that she phrases her review, because she makes it clear that she doesn't think that the movie is for children.
Yeah, right? I mean, the first line of dialogue that we hear in the movie is, Papa, where are we? I don't know, son. Papa, what are we? I don't know that either, son. We'll just have to wait and see. Like, straight out the gate, they're just like, okay, where are we and what are we? And we don't know. Like,
yeah, what is existence?
In. Yeah, we'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah, and it's also faintly disturbing that there are these two creatures with different consciousness, and yet they are stuck together.
They are indeed. Yeah. They're stuck together. They have to move as one unit for most of the movie. And yeah, that's just a crazy idea right there. And then, and it really, the way the movie starts, it kind of just drops you off like that is almost like the point of their birth, or at least the birth of their consciousness as toys, is like the clock striking midnight and whatever strange magic brings all the toys in the toy shop to life, which is just really fun. I love how many different stories in our American cultural lexicon have this concept of a whole room full of toys coming to life.
Very true. It's one that we seem to really enjoy.
Before we get on to the step out of the time machine and join the rest of the party, I want to do a little bit with the cast. I'll go through some of the English language cast first, but I do want to touch a little bit in this section on the Japanese language cast as well, because there is some fun stuff in there.
Okay.
So first off, right out the gate, English language cast. One of the first people that I recognized was John Carradine.
John Carradine.
Who is the father of both David and Robert Carradine. Okay, and he plays the tramp. John Carradine himself is a staple of old Hollywood, was in numerous movies. Obviously, two of his sons are also famous actors themselves. David Carradine being most known for his work in the Kung Fu television show, and then eventually
Kill Bill.
That's right. In addition, I also noticed Cloris Leachman is in this movie as Euterp. She's just got a great voice and was a very good actress. And she's a really cool, noticeable presence. I most know her, I think, from The Last Picture Show.
Okay.
And then one that didn't stick out to me right away, but then while I was watching, Annie actually pointed out that she recognized one of the voice actors in the movie, and it was Peter Ustinov, who plays Manny the Rat. And where she recognized this voice from is that he also voiced both Prince John and King Richard in the Robin Hood animated movie.
I knew his voice sounded familiar, and I could not place it, but oh my gosh, there it is.
I did not recognize the voice right away, and I was just kind of watching the movie on my computer, and Annie was like doing other stuff, and like comes in the room and is just like, oh, that's King Richard from Robin Hood.
Wow.
And it was actually kind of fun looking into Peter Ustinov, because according to Wikipedia, he's quite the Renaissance man. The dude was like a diplomat. I think he worked for UNICEF as some kind of ambassador. He also wrote several books, novellas, novels, short stories, and plays, as well as nonfiction books, and just did a lot of acting. Quite an interesting dude. But I think that was most of the English language cast that I recognized. But I want to take a minute before we have to join the party to get into the Japanese language. One of the folks in here, the person who plays Muskrat, is a person named Kazuo Kumakura. And I was looking at some of his credits. He does the Japanese voice dubs of just a ton of Disney movies.
Oh, wow.
He's the Mad Hatter in Alice in Wonderland. He's Scat Cat in The Aristocats. He's Friend Owl in Bambi. He's Cogsworth in Beauty and the Beast. He's Jasper in 101 Dalmatians. Mr. Smee in Peter Pan. Geppetto in Pinocchio. Like, the list goes on. Like, I mean, he basically just got to be a Japanese dub actor for a super ton of Disney's classic films.
That's incredible. That is quite resume. Quite a resume.
Quite a resume indeed. The next person on my list that seemed pretty interesting was Hiroshi Sakamoto, who plays the mouse. But I also found it funny that though he is the voice actor of the mouse in The Mouse and Child, all it says on Wikipedia is that he's a former swimmer who competed in the 1984 Summer Olympics.
Wow.
I also noticed that the son is also named Sakamoto. It's Atsuko Sakamoto, but that Atsuko Sakamoto doesn't have a Wikipedia page, and I wasn't able to find Atsuko Sakamoto on like IMDb or anything. So I was just wondering if that might be
his actual child.
Yeah, which would be really fun. The next person that I checked into was someone named Goro Naya, who plays the crows. And Goro Naya was the voice actor for Japanese dubs of several Clark Gable, Charlton Heston, and John Wayne films.
He played
a ton of Charlton Heston movies. He does the voice of Charlton Heston in The Greatest Show on Earth, The Ten Commandments, The Big Country, Ben-Hur.
Some really big movies.
Big, big movies. He also did a bunch as John Wayne, and then three movies as Clark Gable. In addition, I also noticed after all of these huge lists of like famous dubs that he did for these three famous old Hollywood actors, he also did the voice for the Japanese dub as Obi-Wan Kenobi in the original
Star Wars.
Wow. So in New Hope, The Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, he is Obi-Wan.
Wow. So some really, really big name voice actors in the Japanese dub.
Oh, yeah. Big, big names. We have a few more just to touch off before we step out of the time machine. The last person that I have on my list is Makio Inoue, who in The Mouse and His Child was one of the paper people.
Oh, in the sitting with the coffee and they just read the newspaper? They're just announcing the newspaper?
Yeah. What an interesting character, the paper people.
Yeah, they can't have any original thoughts. They just regurgitate the newspapers that they were made out of.
Oh, yeah. But one of them was, in the Japanese dub, was voiced by Makio Inoue. And it said that he was the actor of choice in the 1970s for deep-voiced serious males. So I guess he's just got a really cool deep voice.
Okay.
Yeah. But that wraps up all of the stuff that I was able to kind of find on this movie and check into it. A lot of neat voice talent going into this movie and several connections with a lot of other stuff that we've either covered or that finds itself in the well-known cultural lexicon.
Yeah, so. I think it's kind of too bad that this production company didn't make more feature films.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it doesn't look like they made a whole lot. It looks like maybe under 10. A lot of them I don't recognize. I don't know of What's Up Tiger Lily, Catalina Caper, Gas, 200 Motels, Down and Dirty Duck.
Yeah, I've actually watched Down and Dirty Duck because I was curious about...
Was it any good?
It is probably one of the filthiest animated things I've ever seen, and I have not seen Fritz the Cat, but I think that it's supposed to be sort of like Fritz the Cat. I think it was trying to, you know, ride that wave. It is pretty transgressive and offensive. So.
Neat. Wow. Interesting. So some risque animators at Fred Wolf Films at Murakami Wolf.
Yeah, it's very different from A Mouse and His Child.
Yeah. Wild. Oh, man. Well, I'm so glad we got to watch this movie. I'm excited to see what everybody thinks about it and has to say at the party. With that, shall we rejoin our friends at the party and step out of the time machine?
Let's rejoin our Zoom party.
Yeah, magically step back into my bedroom.
Yes. All right.
All right.
Let's go.
All passengers must return to their respective times. Goodbye.
Oh, okay, cool. Well, I mean, first off, I think just because we didn't really get to much of this in the pre-show or while we were in the slow-moving time machine, I'd love to just start out by getting some of y'all's reactions to this movie and what you thought watching it with a group of folks.
It was a fun time. It was a trip.
I think it was brilliant, but I'm not sure.
We actually watched it last night because we couldn't join today. And I was astonished with how much I didn't remember. And then Bailey informed me that we had that, 30 years ago, at least, or longer ago. And it's no wonder I only remembered a few parts. But it's a very different story with different elements thrown in for children you wouldn't expect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't remember it at all. Apparently, I recorded over our VHS, but... Oh, Bailey,
I heard this
I
story that you did, apparently. Always a tragedy to have like a good VHS written over.
During the beginning of this, I was like, this is like the same appeal of Chuck E. Cheese. If you're there as an adult, you're like, with like those animatronic robots, you're like, this is charming and also very creepy. Mm-hmm. I just remember like being, I don't know, older than I should have been at a Chuck E. Cheese and just being like, oh, this is definitely like for small children who like can't digest the like level of creepiness that's going on.
My sister was totally terrified of Chuck E. Cheese and would not enter the establishment.
Whoa. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some spooky stuff going on at those Chuck E. Cheese's.
It kind of reminded me a little bit of the Great Mouse Detective at the beginning when they're all in the toy shop.
I was saying with Bailey, it's pretty interesting how many stories and movies, especially in our cultural lexicon, start with all the toys come alive when the humans go away.
Midnight.
Yeah, at the stroke of midnight with the regulator clock just teaching you the rules of the game, you know?
No crying.
So for anyone who wants to hop in with one of these questions, one of my first ones that I wanted to check in with everybody about is one of the striking moments in this movie is that mise-en-abîme scene where you're just kind of like going into the endless tunnel of the last visible dog. And this concept of like contemplating infinity just sounds so funny for kids. And I'm wondering like if anyone has a moment where like as a very young child, their mind was fully blown by some concept that was like way too much for their tiny brain to like handle. Yeah, Cullen.
When I was a very small child, I had a crippling fear of kaleidoscopes because what? When you shift the pattern in a kaleidoscope, it will never be the same twice. And the thought that the image produced by the kaleidoscope would be gone forever when I changed it was just way too much for my six-year-old brain.
Gone forever is a tough concept. I mean, whether that's the kaleidoscope, human death, personal death, you know, gone forever is a really tough one for a youngin' to grasp.
I mean, humans I can attest are one to thing, that. But a kaleidoscope image? Man, that's important.
I think we need to direct
He did lose question. His mind.
In the chat, it says that the child who's on the Zoom call lost her mind watching the movie. I'd like to hear what she has to say.
Yeah, I would definitely like the child's perspective. That would be really great. Definitely a welcome addition.
Can you tell them what you thought about that movie?
It was good.
She's just totally lost her mind.
She contemplated infinity and now she's gone crazy.
Yeah,
she
got that got that an unicorn
number of laps to do around the kitchen.
Yes.
So when I was a child, we had I think it was a bottle of molasses that had monkeys swinging and holding up the bottle of molasses, which had the label of it, and the monkey swinging and holding up a bottle of molasses.
Yeah.
Okay, was it molasses?
About. It's like, yeah, like a syrup. It's like a kitchen syrup.
And I'm looking at it as a kid, and I'm like, all right, so there's a monkey and the monkey and the monkey. And like, so I knew it had to go on forever into infinity. But then I also had some vague concept about you could only print so detailed. And you couldn't print forever. And I could never rectify those two things in my mind and figure out which one it was. Is the printer right or is the idea right? And it made me very angry.
Yeah, that's awesome that you have like a direct analog. Puka, so I think you had something else to say in response to this question as well, yes?
Yeah, so I remember being a kid, you know, like you hold a mirror up to another mirror and it's like zoop, 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 infinity. I remember like doing that as a child. And then, like, also just, like, staring at that long enough and, like, contemplating my breathing and just being, like, one of these are going to end eventually. And then I, like, walked out. And later, like, I just, like, had this, like, moment of, like, wow, there's, like, infinity and the opposite of infinity are things ending. And later that evening at dinner, we were eating. I remember exactly what we were eating. Really, really bad spaghetti. And I remember looking at my brothers and being, like, one of us is going to have to bury the other two.
Oh, dark. Oh my God. Yes.
I have a thing about those mirrors in the same way, except for mine was always, I think, had something to do with Alice in Wonderland or whatever, and that infinity mirror thing. And I was really afraid to be in like a bathroom that had that, because if I looked and stayed too long, something was going to come out of that to get me from like that infinity, because it could go on forever where anything could happen. And it really freaked me out. Or like a version of me was going to step out of the mirror and switch places with me or something.
Yeah, I had one of those double mirrors as well. And I remember being very frustrated that I couldn't focus on like the fifth dog down this line of infinite dogs. I couldn't find a way to like really focus in and just be like, that one is its own reality. And I like it because anytime I would move, it shifted everything. And I just like couldn't find a point of like settling on it. And I remember that being very frustrating to me.
You know, I do think that it's kind of funny personally that while I did have, as I said, a crippling fear of kaleidoscopes as a child, I'm pretty sure the first time that I saw the double mirror effect as a child, I was just like, huh, that's neat, and just carried on.
You know, nice. Bailey felt responsible, Cullen, for years.
The reason why I felt responsible was because I had a kaleidoscope, and we were at our grandmother's house, and I had found one that I thought was particularly beautiful in the kaleidoscope, and I was trying to show Chaney so that she could be in equal awe of the beauty in this kaleidoscope. And I was handing it to her, and Cullen was very little at the time and didn't understand kaleidoscopes, and he snatched it out of my hand and said, "Let me see." And I said, "Well, Cullen, it's ruined now." It'll never be like that ever again.
Oh no.
Cullen, do you remember it that way?
Whoops.
Yes.
I just remember the meltdown you had when you wouldn't let anybody touch the kaleidoscope because you were so afraid it would be ruined forever. And I said, "But you can't even look at it."
Just remember my six-year-old confrontation with eternal destruction.
Yeah, that's a rough one.
It is a tough one. Before I move on to my next question, it looks like Texana's back, so I want to give you one more chance to answer.
I don't know. I think my internet is just a little slower.
That's okay. It happens.
Okay. Well, I loved the mirror thing. Going way back to that, I had mirrors throughout my entire house as a child, and so my bathroom had floor to ceiling mirrors that went around a corner. I don't know why they designed it that way, but that's the house that we bought. And I would stand in the corner mirror, and I would put my nose up against the corner, and I would just stare at my infinite selves in either direction. I was very fascinated by it. But did anyone ever do that, put your fingers together and bring it close to your face and make a floating little sausage in between? That freaked me out.
Oh, yeah. I definitely did that.
Yeah, same here.
You were a mix between stuck in the mirror and on an acid trip from the movie just now. The end.
It was a really interesting effect that just happened on your voice. It was really great. That was awesome. So my next question that I have for everybody is that, you know, one of the cool concepts of this movie that becomes central is this idea of these toys becoming self-winding and how much they have to rely on others in general throughout the movie all the way until the very end where they finally do become self-winding. So I want to just see if I can get any of y'all's stories of really doing something by yourself for the first time and that being like an experience like where other people had to help you and then you finally got to do something by yourself.
I don't have a lot of childhood memories. Honestly, I don't even remember what happened last week. But one thing that I've been doing lately is working on the podcast with Bailey, and I've also been creating videos. And I've had three people help me, Bailey, Eric, and my boyfriend, Nick. And now I can do it all on my own, and I'm thriving. And I'm very, very excited with all of my new skills.
Chaney is now self-winding.
I am self-winding.
You're a self-winding podcaster. That's so great.
The only thing I can come up with was, and this is going back a zillion years, I was in gymnastics, and we were to the point where we were learning how to do flip-flops and aerials, and an aerial is a car wheel without using your hands. Basically, what we had to do was run from one end on these mats all the way down, and there were supposed to be spotters that had their arms crossed, grabbing the wrists of each other, and they were supposed to hit you on your waist and boost you over. So I was pretty self-confident at the time, and I went running full force, threw myself into it, landed on my feet. It was absolutely amazing, but they never touched me. They weren't paying attention. And it freaked me out so badly that they weren't paying attention. I never did it again. So I was self-winding for about 3 seconds. And then I put my key back in.
I have one. I don't know if this fits super well, but I remember I was probably like 3. I was just over my entire family's crap. And I was like, that's it. I'm leaving. So I packed a bag of pecans. I walked out to the street and I decided to walk because I was running away and I was going to go live my own life and do my own thing at like the age of 3 years old. And I walked down the street and I was like, I'm going to do this. I've got this. And by the time I got to the end of my street, I looked at my bag of pecans and realized that there was no way I was going to make it with just that bag of pecans. And I knew that I didn't know how to make and get more food. So I was like, dang it, I got to go back. Okay.
That's some high order future vision you got there as a 3-year-old.
I was so mad I ate all my pecans by the time I got down the street.
Do you have a bag of pecans now?
Yeah, I don't think I have any pecans anymore.
You finished that bag and that was it.
That was it. That was the it.
One last thing I guess I'll get to before we wrap this up is I found it really interesting how these toys, they're pitted against this very like violent nature. There's rats getting eaten, they almost get eaten, and then at the very end, there's this hawk that determines that they're like not part of the rhythm of nature because they're not part of the circle of life, I guess. And I'm not exactly sure the question I'm trying to ask here. It's like, now it's lost on me. Oh man, it totally just fled my mind. I'm having a Bailey moment right now, guys.
Can I attempt your question?
Yes, you certainly can.
When was the time when you felt like you were not part of the balance of nature?
That's a good one.
The natural order. I appreciate that, Kate Winsor.
Ouch.
Every day.
That wasn't a dig, Bailey. I find your lapses in speech very charming. I find them great.
Your memory static?
We put a lot of thought into the name of this podcast, actually.
One thing that kind of made me think of, which might be a bit of a tangent, I grew up in Louisiana until I was like 10, and then I moved to California, and then I would go visit Louisiana like during the summer and like Christmas breaks. But not completely growing up there, not having like every Mardi Gras off, not being 21 in New Orleans on my 21st birthday or whatever, and not having the other like Louisiana milestones. Like, I don't feel like part of Louisiana nature. And so when I go there, I feel like an interloper, not quite a wind up toy, but like it feels a little different.
Yeah, I definitely vibe with that. I often talk about Texas as kind of hostile territory. Something about the landscape, whether it's the way the allergies get me here or like other things, like I kind of constantly feel like the geography and the climate of Austin is like hostile to my body. I'm like very much out of my natural biome and I'm just kind of like existing in hostile territory.
Yeah.
Eric, to that, I'm in Seattle and just being like a friendly Texan, which is really just like saying hello and being polite to people. I remember my first week here, I was hanging out with a college friend and I said something. I think I was like, do y'all have something here? And then I like jokingly was like, I probably just like really outed myself saying y'all, and the waitress comes up and she's like, yeah, you fucking did.
Oh,
so unfriendly.
Oh man.
Yeah, they actually have a name for it out there in Seattle, the Seattle Freeze.
Seattle, like, too cool for school. Like, mm-hmm. I get it. Everyone in Seattle just, they, like, climb mountains and then they climb back down and, like, type on the computer for, like, the rest of the work week and then, like, climb back up a mountain and climb back down. Mm-hmm. So I feel, like, very out of step here.
Yeah.
That's Seattle, they climb up mountains and they type on the keyboard, then they climb back down. Like, that reminded me of something else from the movie. The axe scene felt, like, super Sisyphusian.
Oh, yeah. Like, it was going to take forever for them to actually cut that thing down.
Yeah, and just like the endless toil.
And like how the mice, they were even drawn like kind of pale white when they reached springtime, like they were so tired and just like out of it.
But is Sisyphus truly suffering if there's a hot background track of operatic math equations?
That's a good point.
Will, you had a story?
Oh, if you can handle one more story about being a fish out of water. When I grew up in Boston, Massachusetts, and then moved when I was 11 years old to Pennsylvania, it was the whole new world thing. There wasn't a scary grandfather clock yelling at me, like it was 1984, but everything was different. They didn't bowl the same way that we bowled in Boston. It was really weird. They had different words for like a sandwich. They had different words for everything. It was so surreal being torn out of your place and stuck in a new one. And I felt that in the film a little bit.
Huh. I gotta ask, what are the main differences between Boston bowling and Philadelphia bowling?
We have candlepin bowling, which are long, really kind of undifferentiated top to bottom pins. And you put them in a series of 10, you roll a ball about yay big, you hold it in one hand, no holes, and you roll it down and the pins that fall, just fall. They don't get swept away. You get to use the pins to hit other pins. It's very exciting. Oh. And then I found this weird way of bowling with huge balls with three holes and these pins that were really, really weirdly sensually shaped, I'm afraid. And totally weird.
Oh my God, thank you so much for sharing that. I'm glad I know about candlestick bowling.
Candlepin,
I'm sorry. Candlepin bowling, yes, absolutely.
I have to say that as somebody from Pennsylvania, I had the opposite experience when I moved away and I kept calling things hoagies and stuff. Everyone was like, what is that? I don't know what you're talking about.
My cousins own a place in New Jersey called the Hoagie Hut, and I grew up calling them hoagies. And when I moved out to Seattle, I remember distinctly being like 5 years old and my parents got a gift from our relatives back in the Northeast. They sent to us like freeze-wrapped hoagies and soft pretzels, but then they also included a little card in there of like a bunch of Philly-isms, what people say in Philadelphia. The only one I remember is jeet yet instead of did you eat yet. It said J-E-E-T, jeet yet.
And, yeah.
jeet yet. And Italy's in Europe instead of Italy is in Europe, which I thought was also very funny. Yes. I mean, they've got some really good accent bits in the Northeast. The first time I ever found out that in Pittsburgh, they don't say y'all, they say yins.
That freaked me out.
That's their word for y'all, y'all.
Yins? I don't say sir, but everyone else in my family does.
Wooder.
Yes, Cullen, yins, as in it's a contraction of you ones, but yins, ewins.
Yins.
Going from Oakland to Austin. When I got here, I pull up in this parking lot and this guy comes up to me. He's like, that's a great car. How are you? And he starts talking to me. And my reaction is like, what do you want? What do you do? Why? Why are you talking to me? And this kept happening where like people were just being friendly. And I just assumed that they were going to want something or need something. And like, having somebody be friendly was really disconcerting.
Yeah, it's a whole new world of experiences there. Yeah.
Welcome to Texas.
It's super great. On that note, I think I'm going to move to me and Bailey and wrap this guy up. So I want to check in with you, Bailey, really quick. First off, happy birthday, Bailey.
It's great to all get together in a party full of people on your birthday.
I love your glasses. Your glasses look so cute, just so you know.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
They're so great.
They're my computer reading glasses.
So I want to just say happy birthday, and then I want to hear how it was to watch this movie again with a party full of people on your birthday.
Well, first of all, I just want to say thank you, everyone, for coming, and it means a lot to see all your faces, and I just really appreciate it. This has been great. I think that this worked well as an experiment
watching this movie online simultaneously with everyone and getting to chat. It was super fun. This is a weird movie, and it makes sense that it stayed with me as long as it did, because it's pretty heady, and I don't think that I could fully process it as a child. And I don't know if I fully process it now either. There's a lot of dialogue in it, a whole lot of dialogue.
Yeah, that was Leonard Maltin's review of this movie was, talk, 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 and no action. Bomb out of 4 stars.
Ouch.
But I dug it. I kind of like a slow movie, although it is pretty heady. And there's a lot of like goofy dialogue too. Like all of the like funny math problems are really interesting dialogue. All the this times this equals this stuff is really wild. And it definitely sets up a world.
Yeah, Ilya says 10 out of 10, she'll never watch it again.
Well, I'm so glad we got to watch this movie together, Bailey.
Yeah.
Get together for another one of these episodes of Memory Static where I get to host and ask you the questions, because you're always the one asking the questions.
Yeah, no, this has been great. And I think this is like, you know, a great one to end the season on.
Yeah.
Cool. I'm excited for the song that'll be in this episode.
Ooh. Me too.
I'm excited.
Should it be about the numbers?
We are
new fans
numbers.
Of Memory Static. We'll get that joke.
I fully expect you to make an opera song out of it, though.
Existential opera song.
Well, thank you for listening to Memory Static. Until next
and
time,
return your videos.
Return
here.
Your videos.
Return
here.
Your videos here.
Videos.
Here.
Here. Please rewind. Be kind.
I never feel as alive as when I'm laughing dead serious. Over the sensibly delirious. The obvious truth could not be more mysterious. Following the smell of the sound, cause I was curious. Oh, I was searching for what I was searching for. What I was searching for. What I was searching for. The last visible dawn. It's the you make me so angry, I am creeping, it's hilarious. One of my other boys, me, but he's oblivious. Frogs are knocked out, but just a little more amphibious. I was searching for, I was searching for some kind of Labrador. Yeah, I was searching for the yes, miserable.
Don't try to come near me, I'll go far away. Don't try to hear me, I've got nothing to say. Don't try to know me, I'll shapeshift my face. And don't run away, or I'll
fall out in chains.
Thank you for listening to Memory Static. This episode was produced by me, Bailey Moore. The original song, The Last Visible Dog, was written special for this episode in collaboration between me and Cullen Moore. You can find more of his music by visiting plaidtuxedo.com or finding Plaid Tuxedo on YouTube. Thank you to Eric Dumig for coming back to host this episode on my birthday, which was back in December. And thank you for all of our party guests. This is the last episode of the second season, but we've already been building a backlog for season 3. We'll be taking a few months break to write the songs, but there will be a few bonus episodes I'll be releasing in the interim. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook to learn about future events. If you have any stories about any of the movies we've covered or any of the questions asked on any of these episodes, write to me at memorystatic@gmail.com. I want to hear your stories. Other than that, if you like what you hear, please consider rating and reviewing Memory Static or supporting us on Patreon. Thank you again for listening. All my love to all of you. Bye.